state of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you all. Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court. Hearing cases at the University of Idaho College of Law today. The date today is April 19, 2023, and the first case before this court this morning is Watkins v. City of Ponderay. In this matter, the appellant is Michael Watkins, represented by Michael Kessinger, and the respondent, City of Ponderay, is represented by Lewis E. Marshall III. Gentlemen, do either of you have any preliminary matters for the court?
Your Honor, I mentioned to the clerk, the docket reads that it's Goykechea Law Offices, LLP, Boise, representing the appellant. It's actually Goykechea Law, LLC, Lewis.
All right, thank you for that correction. We'll make note of that.
No matter to respond.
Very well. With that then, Mr. Kessinger, you may proceed, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, opposing counsel, may it please the court, we're close. I represent Officer Michael Watkins, the injured worker and appellant in this action. The legislature in Idaho Code Section 72201 declared that Idaho workers' compensation law provides sure and certain relief to injured workers. The court recently reiterated that sure and certain relief for injured workers is the ultimate goal of the workers' compensation system. Since Idaho workers' compensation laws were passed in 1917, this court has repeatedly held that workers' compensation laws are to be liberally construed to secure benefits to all those who were intended to receive them. In this case, the parties agree on the pertinent facts. Defendant employer readily admits that it failed to pay Officer Watkins as required under Idaho Code 72-1104. Naming Idaho Code 72-1104 requires that the injured peace officer shall be paid his or her full rate of base salary until the temporary disability arising from such injury has ceased. Defendant employer admits that it should have paid Officer Watkins consistent with the Act, yet the defendant employer has categorically refused to make any salary payments to Officer Watkins since his injury in 2018. Officer Watkins' relief has been anything but sure and certain in this case. After refusing for over 2 years to pay Officer Watkins' salary, defendant employer asked the Idaho Industrial Commission to fashion a non-statutory remedy for a situation defendant employer had created. The Industrial Commission accepted the defendant employer's invitation and ignored the plain language of the law, creating a non-statutory workaround.
So, Mr. Kessinger, you wrote in your brief that the Commission's award to the city an unlawful credit for workers' compensation benefits will deter attorneys from representing injured officers.
Correct.
Could you explain why you made that statement and how it has a practical effect?
Sure. So, as you all know, most attorneys in the state of Idaho, I think all attorneys in the state of Idaho, represent injured workers on a contingency basis. And if counties, cities, the state get a credit, then the amount of disputed benefits is going to be small. In this case, there would have been a period of time where there was no disputed benefits, just the law has been ignored. So, just for example, if the salary payment was going to be $800, and the time loss payment is $700, there's only $100 difference. So the city could, for a whole year, refuse to pay properly the salary payments, and in that case, there would only be $1,200 in dispute because the credit would, in essence, make the dispute $100 for each, or I'm sorry, $5,200. But the credit would make the dispute very small and not worth a contingency attorney pursuing.
I want to be clear then, just make sure I'm understanding where we are, and I understand attorneys need to be paid. I used to be one and I like to be paid. But this case isn't really about your client not getting something he's entitled to, but it's the way that he was awarded it is affecting your ability to recover attorney's fees?
No, Your Honor. He didn't get something he was supposed to get. The law said he should have got it.
Okay, so what is your client missing out on then? What is the amount of damage that the resolution has caused him?
So we don't have the numbers, actually. We can't do that math problem at this point. The statute's mandatory. It says that my client shall receive his salary, then he shall remit his time loss payment. He never received a salary payment, so we don't know how that math works out. We don't actually know what a salary payment would have been. The statute, frankly, doesn't tell us what a full rate of base salary is, which creates an issue in this case as well, an issue that we can't get to at this point, but a math problem that we don't know the answer to.
I thought the parties have taken the position that the statutes are unambiguous.
Yes. With respect to the question before the court, the statute is unambiguous.
So why can't we figure out how much your client's owed then?
Because we don't know what his base rate of salary is. That's not the issue before the court. The issue before the court is whether it's mandatory that a county or a city, the city of Ponderay in this case, pay Mr. Watkins his full rate of base salary.
So moving beyond this, this dispute, there's still an ongoing dispute between these parties as to the amount of money that's owed? And I'm not even talking about the offset. I'm talking about just...
Potentially, yes. Almost certainly, there's a dispute about the amount of money owed. And there is, back to Justice Moore's question, there is, it's our position there is money owed. There's a question about what it is, how much it is.
Help me explain, understand why it's so hard to figure out what his salary should be. I don't understand what the problem is with calculating that.
Well, it's not in evidence, for one. Defendant's answer is in the commission record. That's an allegation as to what his payments were.
Why isn't it in the record? It would have seemed like that would have been the first thing to figure out before this went through the entire process that brings us here.
Well, the way this worked, Your Honor, was we filed a complaint. The complaint wasn't answered. We filed a notice of intent to default. That wasn't responded to. We filed for default, and we default the defendants, asked the commission for an award. The referee, who wrote the initial decision, indicated that the salary was, his opinion was the base rate of salary would be based on Officer Watkins' earnings and would have been $1,140.68. The city took the position that the base rate of salary was $896 gross, $521.65 take home after deductions. So those are the two numbers we have in the evidence. And again, the complaint, it's an allegation, it's in response, it's the answer. But those are the numbers we have. So that's how we got here. It was our position that it was really straightforward that the county shall pay, pursuant to statute, Officer Watkins' salary. And that was an easy question, but here we are.
So if it happens like it should, Officer Watkins just keeps drawing a paycheck from the county like normal, and then you make your complaint to the commissioner, or your work comp complaint, gets fleshed out whatever his lost time benefit is, and then whatever that payment is goes right back to the county. Is that how this should have worked in your mind?
That's how it should have worked in my mind. And the commission has previously indicated that's how it should work, that in essence, Officer Watkins would receive his salary payment from the county, and then he would receive his time loss payment from the state insurance fund, or whoever the surety is, and then Officer Watkins would remit that time loss payment to the county.
Let me ask you, just delving into the facts of what happened a little bit. It appears your client waited for over a year after the accident to make a demand for the full salary. Am I reading the record correctly?
As far as the record goes, I think the first record of a demand for salary, a letter that was sent by me to the county, and that may have been about a year. I can figure that out exactly if you'd like.
So I have the injury is August 18th, 2018. Your letter is September 12th, 2019.
Correct.
And then your letter is 9 days after a letter that your client received from the surety saying that they were going to reduce his TTD benefits.
That sounds about right, yeah.
And so help me remember, because it's been a while since I've looked at this, are TTD benefits taxable?
The Industrial Commission will tell you that generally TTD benefits are not taxable. I'm not a tax attorney. I don't think the Industrial Commission needs it either, but they have said that generally TTD benefits are not taxable.
And so when I'm looking at the record trying to figure out what happened for for the first 52 weeks after the injury, he received 90% of his salary, correct?
Correct.
And let's assume that's not taxable. And so he doesn't ask the city for any sort of pay me my full salary. If he had been paid his full salary, it would have been fully taxed, because that's under the statute, correct?
Correct.
And then after he gets notice from the surety, hey, it's been 52 weeks at 90%, we're going to drop you to 67% of your salary, he goes ahead and sends a letter to the city and says, now I want my full salary. Am I reading that correctly?
I don't know if that was it. It sounds like you're saying that was a trigger, and whether it was or not for the letter, I don't know at this point. I don't recall.
At any rate, your letter was sent 9 days after the surety notified him that we're going to drop your benefits from 90% to 67%.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. And so from a policy standpoint, and this may not impact at all the interpretation of the statute, because we interpret the plain language of the statute, but it appears there may be support in the record for the city's contention that the city and your client agreed we don't need to pay you your salary as long as you're receiving 90% of benefits. So that, help me work through that.
That may be true.
Okay.
I don't know the specifics of that.
Okay.
I don't have anything to say that's not true.
Okay. Thank you.
At risk of boring you all, and I know that you understand most of this, I'm going to talk a little bit more about TPE benefits. We just talked about them briefly, because it doesn't matter in this case. Generally, time loss benefits are 67% of a person's wage, unless they're a high wage earner. And then they're 90% for 1 year. And after a year, they go to 67% of the average state wage. And so that's what happened in this case. He received 90%, and then he dropped to 67%. Effective 2007, however, the legislature added Chapter 11 of Title 72 and said that peace officers and detention officers who are injured in the line of duty get 100% of their base rate of salary. And so that's what brings us here today. To accomplish this, we have this scenario where the injured worker receives both the full salary and the benefits from the insurance carrier and then remits those. And as Justice Son, as you pointed out, this taxability creates potentially an issue here as far as what Officer Watkins was netting. And that brings us to that other issue that's not before the court, which is what is a full rate of base salary, which we've already talked about. The Industrial Commission in 2014, there's only one case that's addressed this code section. The court, this is an issue of first impression for the court. I don't think this code section is ever written before the court. But the Industrial Commission, summarizing this in 2014, and this is a decision written by the commissioner, said, to summarize, a claimant first receives full salary from an employer and workers' compensation income benefits. At first, the claimant receives what appears to be double payment, but that is corrected by the next requirement. The claimant then gives the eligible employer any workers' compensation income benefits received during that time period. So that was the Industrial Commission's assessment of the statute in 2014. Fast forward to today, the commission concedes that 72104 is unambiguous. It's in their decision that it's unambiguous, but abandoned the summary application that it set forth in Sloan, fashioning a non-statutory approach to 72104, giving defendant employer credit. The substance of the commission's opinion actually is very brief. It's paragraphs 10 and 11 where they set forth their analysis. The commission says, in his application for default judgment, prima facie case, claimant asked the commission to order employer to pay him his base salary applicable to the period of recovery. However, claimant did not acknowledge a corresponding duty to remit the TTD/TPD payments he already received. Such a resolution is not cognizable under the Act. To abide by the unambiguous requirements of IC 72104, the employer must pay claimant his full rate of base salary minus income tax deductions for the entire period of recovery. Further payments made to the claimant by surety for temporary disability must be remitted by claimant to employer. Here we assume that claimant has applied the TPD/TPD payments he received from surety to expenses incurred as a result of living without his customary salary. employer should receive a credit for TPD / TPD payments received by claimant. This complies with the intent of IC Section 72-1104, subsection 2.
Now, there's a difference between what you just read, which was from the Industrial Commission, versus the findings that were made by the referee, wasn't there? The words are very close, but they're not identical.
Then you got something I didn't.
Well, for example, in paragraph 11, when you were reading the Industrial Commission, you said that it would be not cognizable under the Act. But paragraph 11 says such a resolution would be inequitable under the Act.
Right.
Is there not an important difference there?
There is. There is. The referee's decision isn't binding, so I didn't spend as much time on it. Definitely a difference. Yes.
So how do we reconcile that? It appeared that the referee thought that to do what's being done here was an act of equity, and it looks like the Industrial Commission wasn't comfortable making an equitable decision, and so they called it something else.
Well, where Title 72, it's a purely statutory scheme, so equity doesn't come into play in a workers' compensation case.
So you're saying the referee got it wrong then?
Yes, and I think the commission got it wrong as well. One of the things I struggle with in these two paragraphs is the commission doesn't tell us what about this. They don't tell us what the resolution is. I think the assumption in the commission decision is that Officer Watkins is going to make off with his salary payments and his time loss payments, but the commission never says that. But I would assume that's what they're saying. When they say such a resolution is not cognizant under the Act, I assume that's what they said, but I don't know because they haven't actually said it.
Well, they say what they said was he doesn't have it. We assume that he doesn't have the money.
Right, yeah.
Right?
An assumption, and I think it's probably a fair assumption, an assumption nonetheless. They assume that he's going to make up with the money. I don't know how else to read that. If it's not...
You think it's fair for the Industrial Commission to assume what somebody has done with the money?
No, I don't think it's fair.
Okay.
I think that's a fair assumption. I don't think it's fair for the Industrial Commission to make any assumptions in its decision.
So what's the order on remand that you're seeking?
That the commission apply the statute as written, that defendant employer pay Officer Watkins his full rate of base salary. The commission stuck with the problem that it's already acknowledged in this decision, which is we don't know what full rate of base salary is. Isn't that something that can be explored with defendant employer to see if we can reach an agreement on that? But just that the statute be applied as written.
And that the claimant be ordered to repay or to pay to the city the amount that he received in benefits?
That's the statute as written. And how that worked, Justice Steger, at this point, I don't know. We're quite a mess because it wasn't done properly at the front end. In this case, if the benefits are now paid as they should have been, by defendant employer, I assess an attorney fee on that money. There may not be enough money left now to reimburse the employer or to remit the payments to employer as envisioned by statute because of the sequence of events that happened here.
So if we order the claimant to repay the benefits that he's received, we may penalize him?
Absolutely. And again, this is something that's been created by not following the statute in the first place. If the statute's followed in the first place, we're not here. We might be here on a different issue with this code section, but we're not here about a full salary payment.
Let me ask you one question I had, and this sort of follows up on Justice Stegner's questions. When I look at your letter, your September 12, 2019 letter, at the end, what I would call your demand paragraph, it's in bold. You request the police department immediately forward payment for the full rate of base salary. Your last sentence says, pursuant to the statute, we will determine what workers' compensation received by Michael up to this time should be remitted to the city of Ponderay. What do you mean by what workers' compensation shall be remitted?
How much?
Why wouldn't it be all?
Precisely Justice Stegner's question. The attorney fees would be assessed on that. And then we end up in a situation where there's not enough money left to reimburse the city the full amount of what Officer Watkins had received in TPE benefits.
Why do you get to take your fees before he remits the full payment?
My fees would come out of the salary payments that I obtained from the county or from the city in this case.
Right, but I'm wondering, why do you get to take those fees before he remits what he owes to the county? Why aren't you second? You're saying you're first and the county's second. Why isn't the county first, or the city first and you're second?
Because what I've obtained is Officer Watkins' salary payments. I haven't obtained his TTE payments. He got those. He's arguably, per statute, responsible to remit those. But again, this is a situation that the city has created, not him. And it's put him in, it puts him in a pickle, there's no question. But I would say on personal line, because those are benefits that I obtained.
The statute doesn't encompass the possibility of him paying less than what he's received.
Well, the statute does say in subsection 2, I believe, and I left my code book over there, that if there's a dispute, that goes before the commission. And so that would be a dispute that may well end up in front of the commission if that were to happen.
But
if there were insufficient funds after fees to repay the city, that the TTD benefits Officer Watkins had received, or if Officer Watkins didn't have those funds, it could be that those are sitting in his bank account. I don't know. If those are sitting in his bank account, then that's not a problem. He brings the money to my office, or he sends the money to the city. Then I see my money is expungible, so it's not necessarily earmarked as TTD benefits. Officer Watkins, per statute, owes what he's received in TTD benefits to the city once they've made that salary payment.
But my understanding of the attorney's fee regulations is that attorney's fees attached to the benefits that the attorney's efforts, and I'm not going to get the buzzword right, the legal term correctly, but it attaches basically to what your efforts create, you know, the pot of money that you create. And it seems to me, isn't the pot of money that you're creating here the difference between the TTD benefits and what the employer actually owes? That is to say, I mean, he already is entitled to those TTD benefits. I mean, what you're getting him is the difference between the TTD and his total base salary.
And that's what the commission says, and I disagree with that assessment.
Okay.
I'm getting 100%, assuming that I prevail, I'm getting him 100% of his base salary. He hasn't been paid any of it. He's received $0 for that up to this point.
I think that's going to be an interesting appeal. I have one last question about that. I'm somewhat concerned about the piecemeal nature of this case. I mean, it seems to me that we've got three super important issues. I mean, we've got the issue of set-off, whether the Industrial Commission can order a set-off in the first place. And then we have the issue of, first and foremost, from your client's perspective, how much money is he owed? And then the third thing is going to be your attorney's fees. And I understand that attorney's fees sometimes get divorced on appeal from the main action, but I mean, we're going to end up with three potential appeals from this case, aren't we?
Perhaps. And the statute may not be constitutional. There's a fourth one for you. because in a situation like that, police officers often work overtime, and a lot of it. If you look at Officer Watkins' wages, he's got a month where I think he makes $10,000, a month where he makes $14,000, ballparking. But if the 4A base salary is what the city alleges in his complaint, he's way better off. This statute would actually require him to get a check for $596, or whatever the complaint said, and then take his check for $677 to the city and give it to them. So there's that issue as well, Justice Brody. So just one more to add to the list. But I frankly didn't anticipate that 4A base salary was going to be a dispute as far as whether the city should pay that as mandatory. I thought this was an easy issue. The other ones get more complex, I believe. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Parker.
Sitting here few times, you know, just a mistake that we used to talk about county instead of city. And I just, obviously, it doesn't mean anything. But in a sense, it does. And I'll tell you why. Because the city of Pomeroy has less than 1,500 people in it.
Council, could you speak up just a little bit? I'm not sure our audience will be able to hear you.
Yes, sir. Sorry, I got a little broad in my throat this morning. But when I started doing work for the city, which was many years ago now, I was just noticing that the things have changed here in the courtroom. We used to have law books back there. We now have a table that adjusts matter. You could hit the up button and it goes up and stuff. So but we're coming a long way here at the U of I. But when I started many years ago for the city of Pomeroy, it had 650 people in the entire city. It's essentially a bedroom community for Sandpoint. It's a little unusual of a small city, though, in that it is the commercial hub of Bonner County. And so for that reason, about 25 years ago, the city determined that it was going to start up a police department and not just rely upon the Bonner County Sheriff's Office. And so you got essentially a four-man unit that became a five-person. I think when Officer Watkins was there, it was five people, and now it's seven. So the city is growing. But like typically, any of you that have ever represented small cities in Idaho, there is one central figure in any small city. It is not the mayor. It is not the city attorney. It is not anyone other than the city clerk. The city clerk runs the entire organization. I don't think that there's probably an exception to that rule across our great state. Here, I noticed in the record, on page 26, you actually have a little bio of Sue Warren, our former clerk who was doing that. And so that person has many different hats to wear, including payroll a lot of times. Clearly, she didn't understand the law that had been enacted in 2007 with the subsequent amendments that were done a few years after that. And as counsel has pointed out, it was done wrong. There's no question about that. The city's never denied that. And so here we are. I think this is more a case about remedy and what is Officer Watkins entitled to than it is really even about statutory interpretation or things of that nature. And looking through...
Isn't that the problem that was created? Was the commission ignored the statute?
It did.
As far as I'm concerned, it did.
It did, in a sense, Justice Finger. But it's something that the statute would not anticipate, because the statute is plain and unambiguous on how it's set up.
Well, just because the statute is plain and unambiguous and didn't anticipate something doesn't mean we get to change the law.
Right, but are you changing the law by allowing an offset?
Well, we are ignoring the statute by allowing an offset. That's how I see it.
It's a sense of we're here. You know, I mean, what happened?
I try to be pragmatic in everything I do on this bench, but at the same time, I am not allowed to ignore statutes.
Right. So there also is case law, obviously. It was pointed out that the Corbettelli case that it disallowed any type of setoffs, but that case specifically dealt with disability, physical impairment benefits, as opposed to wage loss benefits. And so I think there's a distinction there. So I understand that the statute is unambiguous, but the remedy fashioned by the Industrial Commission is not disallowed by either statute or, I would argue, the Corbettelli case.
Did the city argue for a credit? Did the city make an argument below for that you'd be granted a credit, or did the commissioner or the referee just come up with this as an equitable remedy, as Justice Mueller said?
Yes, Chief Justice, we were defaulted.
Right, so they just did this kind of on their own.
Yes, sir. We certainly agree with what the...
Right, I'm here supporting that decision, but we didn't argue for it below.
No, correct, because we were defaulted. It makes sense, though. I mean, we're talking about wage loss payments. Why would we not offset the benefits that were given to the officer? Justice Singer, there's a mandatory duty on both sides. So the statute's unambiguous. So subsection 2 says that the officer shall remit his wage loss payments to the city or whoever the employer is.
And I'm confident if a claim had been made by the city against Mr. Watkins, that the commission would have ruled in the city's favor in that regard.
Perhaps.
I have no reason to believe that they would have done anything other than that.
Perhaps.
You said perhaps. I have no reason to think otherwise.
I agree.
My question would be, and it goes back to the difference between the referee's proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law versus the industrial commission's, and that is, what authority does the industrial commission have to fashion any kind of equitable remedy?
And I guess the corresponding question is, why don't they have that? I understand that they are set up by statutes.
That's right. The industrial commission doesn't have any powers other than those that the legislature gives them. They're not a court of general jurisdiction. Equity doesn't enter into what they do. So there has to be some statutory basis for their actions, right?
Yes, ma'am. But when counsel's argument, everyone readily agreed that they often fashion what attorney's fees are. So it's not just set by statute what that is. They also determine what the base rate of salary is, which
right.
the council...
Right, but that's not equity. That's they've been given statutory discretion to determine what's reasonable.
Correct.
That's not the same as equity.
Correct. Correct. Should there be?
Well, I'm not sure that's the question we're going to answer for you. We're not going to tell this legislature how they should have written the statute.
I understand that. You don't have to answer that, frankly. You could just remand back. You could uphold their decision. And this case is not over.
How do we uphold their decision when they exercise equitable discretion that they don't have?
The outcome, you certainly have equitable discretion. And the outcome of this case is...
But we don't freely review their decision. We can't bless them with equity when they don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't create some authority that they don't have. That's my struggle here. They simply don't have this authority. The statute doesn't grant them this authority. The statute didn't. I appreciate, and I represented my fair share of small cities and counties when I was doing high crime work early in my career, so I completely understand what you're saying. But the reality is, the statute mandated the city do something that it didn't do. And I don't know how we read something into the statute that's not there to excuse the city's mistake.
And in fairness, are you aware of anything in the statute that would give the commission equitable powers?
No, not in the statute. Not in the statute. But you certainly have those powers. And looking at this case, I mean, as you ferreted out with counsel before, I mean, this it's really about what the number is in terms of what the contingency attorney fees is going to be. It's not the difference of whether the officer is going to receive his money or not. He certainly will. Going back to what the referee's number as opposed to what the city came up with, it sounds like it's about $200 difference. That's not enough money to be at this body to be fighting about. I mean, I think the city would just... Council was nice enough to say that perhaps the two entities would figure it out and come up with a number. You know, certainly we could rely on what the referee said. Now, I understand the commission did not agree with what the referee came up with on the base rate, the gross base rate. But that's not enough money to fight. What we're really dealing with here is the amount of attorney's fees that are going to be caused by this.
Would it profit us any? If we look at the terminology in this unambiguous statute, as the party have said it is, and determine whether or not maybe we're clear on what the terminology actually means, the statute uses the word reimburse. We've been using the words credit, set off here today. Are these terms of art that mean different things, or are they synonymous the way they're being thrown around here?
It's a question I can't answer. I don't think they're synonymous.
I mean, I guess is a reimbursement the same thing as a credit?
I don't get our view.
Well, let me throw a wrench in
over here.
The reimbursement,
nothing new about that.
reimbursement language pertains to the employer's ability to be reimbursed by the peace officer and detention officer temporary disability fund. The language with regard to Mr. Watkins is he shall remit as applicable any benefits.
In subsection 2, yes.
Right. And so it's the remit first, and then the city can apply for reimbursement if there's a gap.
Right.
And then they get a credit for what they overpaid? Or he gets a credit for what he overreceived?
Yes.
To which?
Yes. But that does go, the fact that there is a state fund out there, I think it goes to show that, you know, even if you were worried that a city is going to be a bad actor and somehow short the police officer, employees, there's absolutely no reason for it, because they can seek reimbursement from the state fund on the back end if there's a difference between the payments, the surety payments to the employee, and the payments made by the city salary payments. So it really doesn't make sense that the city would purposely do this. And there's nothing in the record to indicate that the city purposely did this in any way.
Well, let's walk down that path for just a second. And I don't want to go all X-Files on everybody here, but it's clear this was an officer that was injured in the line of duty.
Yes, sir.
The city respected him, respected his sacrifice, recognized this was a good employee that got injured doing what he was supposed to do. And it seems like every decision that was made in this case up to a certain point was made to the advantage of the employee, that Watkins was able to get 90% tax-free of his salary. And then when that changed to a lesser amount with taxes, then suddenly we change. Now we're going to do it based on a different calculus. It just seems, I'm not suggesting necessarily that there was some kind of side deal, but it seems like even letting the default happen, everything the city did seemed to benefit this valued employee. And now all of a sudden we're fighting about it because the attorneys may not get paid fairly.
The city was naive, there's no question about that, and that goes back to, as I said, you know, anyone who's dealt with city clerks have done everything. They just do what they're going to do. The city was naive and thought that the Industrial Commission would just sort of swoop in, figure out what the right number was, tell us what we owe, and we would write a check.
But were they more than just naive? Were they trying to get this valued employee the best deal, the most payout he could get?
Of course.
And that's what created this mess, right?
Ironically, Justice, yes, that, you know, the road to somewhere is paved with good intentions.
And someone ends up having to pay for that.
Yes, sir.
And it feels like that's what we're determining today.
Yes, sir.
So let me ask you about that, because your response and your request to set aside the default before the Industrial Commission suggests there was an agreement between the city and Mr. Watkins. We don't have to pay you. You go ahead and collect your TTE benefits. As I understood the beginning of your argument today, it was that the clerk didn't realize this statute had been passed. So which is it?
No, ma'am. There was definitely an agreement, but had the clerk known that the statutory language forbid it, she wouldn't have done that. I mean, she would have understood, or she would have come to me and we would have looked at it and said, I don't care what you want to do or what's beneficial to Mr. Watkins, you have to follow the statute. So it was both. I mean, it was an agreement, but she didn't realize that she couldn't do it under state statute.
And so my struggle, I don't think we can get to equity, but if we can get to equity, my struggle with crafting an equitable remedy is the city's the one that made the mistake here. And so why should the city get rewarded to the detriment of Mr. Watkins being able to find an attorney who will take the case? Because his attorney sent a demand letter. It went unanswered. We weren't able to work something out. He filed a complaint. The complaint went unanswered. So he's trying to resolve this. Why should the city's mistake be foisted upon Mr. Watkins such that an attorney's going to say, I can't take this case. I'm not going to get paid.
And I don't think we're arguing that. We're just arguing that the artificially high number that the contingency will be based on is too high. Clearly, I think that the Industrial Commission under, and I forgot the statute, this is not my area of expertise, but the law, I think, is that the Industrial Commission is able to set reasonable attorney's fees. So if this case got remanded, as the Industrial Commission tried to do, we figure out what the number is, and then the Industrial Commission sets an attorney's fees for plaintiff.
But aren't the attorney's fees based on that number? And so isn't that why we're here? Is the number the difference, or is the number the full amount of wages?
I understand that argument. I am not positive, but I think that the Industrial Commission can go, even though the amount may be very small, as counsel pointed out, the full base rates, their salary, and the surety payments, that may not be a big number. I acknowledge that. I don't think it is, and I think that's one of the reasons why the city is fighting this. But I don't know if the Industrial Commission is constrained to do a contingency off of that number. I do not know that. I think that they likely do have what we call equity or powers to give reasonable attorney fees to plaintiff's counsel, which would take into account that there were more issues other than just that small number gap that the officer was owed.
Well, as suggested by Justice Brody, it would be the net number, not the gross number, because you haven't really prevailed to get the gross number. But that begs the question as to attorney's fees in this process. What has the city done that has been reasonable to deny benefits that were admittedly owed to Mr. Watkins?
I think what the best argument is the city is not trying to deny benefits.
Have they paid one?
No, they have not paid them, no.
Have they calculated them?
No, neither has plaintiff. It's difficult because I agree with counsel. Well, it should be an easy calculation on what this number is. It's not defined by statute. So the statute in that respect is not ambiguous in a sense because he obviously does this for a living. Counsel does this for a living. I've looked at it in preparation for this. It's not easy to figure out what that actually means, whether that does entail overtime or not. I think in the record you have a page from the Industrial Commission asking for a workup sheet, and they say don't include overtime, don't include special wages, holiday pay. Is that consistent with the statute? I'm not entirely sure it is. I trust them because they're the Industrial Commission. But I don't know the answer to that.
So you're waiting for guidance from the Industrial Commission as to how to calculate base wage?
I don't know if we'll get there because they didn't give it to us in the remand order from the Industrial Commission.
Didn't give you what?
They just said calculate the full base rate. They didn't say here's what it is. The referee did, but they didn't accept the referee's advisement on that, his recommendation on that. What I was saying to Phil Smaller is our calculation of 896 and the referees of 1100 something is not a big enough deal to be here. So I don't think that's the issue. I understand it seems like it could be, but that's an issue that I don't think would come back before the court.
Is there a reason why the Industrial Commission didn't calculate the number and just sent it back that you attorneys figured out? It doesn't sound like the Industrial Commission to me.
I was surprised. Again, I don't do these cases, but that's clearly what the city expected is that these are the experts. They will give us a number and we will pay the check, whatever that is. It's just the city wasn't going to just hand over a large sum of money and then try to pay those attorney's fees off of that contingency on that large sum and then try to seek the reimbursement from the officer that we don't even know where he is potentially. I mean, I know the statute says that he has to remit those surety payments, but in reality, it's hard to convince the city to trust someone that they don't have a relationship with anymore.
So, where does this, I mean, if we were to affirm the Industrial Commission's decision, where does that leave the parties? What happens next? I mean, and what happens if there's a disagreement over the amount?
I think it goes back to the Industrial Commission. I have thought about that issue. I believe it will go back before the Industrial Commission. So essentially, the commission has remanded this to the parties to figure out whatever that number is and then perhaps figure out whatever reasonable attorney's fees is for plaintiff's counsel. If we can't do that, then I think that the petitioner goes back before the Industrial Commission and says, the city has only offered us this much in insurance fees. I don't think that's a reasonable amount. I think that they can do that under the statute.
there sufficient evidence currently in the record that the Industrial Commission can do that, or will they have to reopen fact-finding?
I think if there was a dispute, they probably would have to reopen fact-finding. But I think it would be limited in the sense that they may just have to look at the amount of work that
comes. What I'm getting at with my question is maybe they didn't calculate it because they didn't have enough information to calculate it.
That's possible.
And that would be on the attorneys then, wouldn't it?
We were defaulted out, which I understand is not this attorney. So,
and I'm assuming that was a calculated choice.
Yes and no. We filed a motion. It was 90K on the part of Sydney and then perhaps even myself that we would have a referee that would come in, tell us what the number is, and the city would write a check. But strategically, no. No, sir, I'm not going to say that was a good strategy. It was not.
So far as we've talked about attorney fees, I know from the Pelham's brief they seek fees on appeal because the city has fought against the mandate of the statute unreasonably. Do you want to address that?
Obviously, we are asking that you uphold the decision of the Industrial Commission, and so attorney fees would be proper if you did. And the alternative, if you were to reverse their decision, we'd argue that what we've done here is not frivolous. We have not taken any actions that try to thwart our duty to the employee. We're just trying to figure out what the right number is.
And well, so 72804 says an employer would be liable if it neglects or refuses to pay an injured worker compensation provided by law without reasonable grounds. You seem to say that you know you owe something, but you don't know what it is. And when I found myself as a lawyer in your position, we would calculate an amount and tender a check, and then we would fight about the difference, not say, well, we don't know what we owe.
I think that's a legitimate criticism of Justice Sanger, for sure. I have obviously contemplated that. I think that the issue is that it's really difficult to ascertain what it is when you deal with the tax consequences. The Justice Zong mentioned before on 90% that wasn't taxed on those. It's just really, really hard to come up with that number.
Why does that play into it? I mean, why wouldn't you just, if, when you submit the base salary number to the Industrial Commission, why wouldn't you just use that as the salary, calculate the deductions based on that, and say, here's what we think we owe you?
And that's exactly it. I mean, this court upholds that decision, that's exactly what we would do.
But why haven't you already done that?
I guess just because it got appealed so quickly that at that point we knew it was coming to its final.
Parties can't continue to negotiate during an appeal?
Of course. The demand was, it was unambiguous on what the demand was and it wasn't accepted.
Speaking for myself, I would just suggest the two of you seem probably better qualified to resolve this minor distinction than we do. I mean, we're not going to be able to. We're going to have the Industrial Commission figure this out.
I don't see how, regardless of who you rule for, that it doesn't include a remand back down to the Industrial Commission.
Wow, but that's something I'm puzzling over. I mean, I don't see. I mean, our decisions are, if we affirm, we affirm. We don't remand. The case is over. From our perspective, it is over. It's here.
Yes.
It's here under and the decision reads that it's final under 72718. Gave 20 days to appeal. I mean, if we affirm, that's it.
Yes.
And then there's no remand from us. The only way that there's a remand is if we don't agree with how they've interpreted the statute in terms of allowing for this set off credit reimbursement, whatever you want to call it.
Yes, ma'am. That was, I think, there was a jury, a trial lawyer, trying to play appellate lawyer today and inartfully used the word remand. It would act as a remand for the parties, but it would not be a remand. You would make a decision, but the net effect on us is we would still have to figure out what these numbers are and try to come up with it.
Well, you have to start over, don't you? I mean, don't you? And maybe Mr. Kessinger can address this. I mean, I don't even know. I don't even know what the procedural mechanism would be with the Industrial Commission, whether it's some kind of declaratory judgment, or I think their JRP 12, or whether it's going to be a new application. I mean, the procedural posture of this case is a little bit concerning in that regard, because you have an incomplete adjudication of the dispute.
Yes, ma'am, we did not. You know, it would have been helpful had we received a little bit more guidance from the Industrial Commission on the decision.
So this affects my view of the tenability, then, of their request for appellate attorney's fees, because you've taken the position that you want the Industrial Commission's decision upheld on appeal. You're defending their decision. But you come before us today acknowledging that it has to be remanded. We have to calculate these numbers. And so if you really believe that their decision was flawed, maybe your position on appeal should have been a little different then. Maybe there should have been a cross appeal, for example. Or
perhaps so, Justice. My reading of their decision is they are essentially directing us, which I call the remand, but they're essentially directing the parties to go and do that. So I interpreted their decision to do that. They're directing the parties to go back and figure out what these numbers are and then come back.
So why didn't, again, I think we've asked this before in a different way, but why didn't that happen? If the Industrial Commission said, you guys figure it out, they file an appeal, which is a right, you stop talking and never figured it out.
I think because of the amount of difference in what the attorney's fees would probably be from if you determine that they can't offset, as opposed if they can offset, are so big. Which I understand before this body, let's say it's $30,000 or $40,000 in attorney's fees, I understand that's not a very big number for cases that this body deals with, but for a small city, it is.
Very well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Clerk, how much time does he call it have remaining?
7 minutes, Your
Honor. 7 minutes, sir.
Thank you. There's been a lot of talk about base rate of salary, all kinds of things. We're here because the Industrial Commission didn't follow the law. That's why we're here. We're not here because of attorney fees or because of base rate of salary. We're here because the Industrial Commission didn't follow the law. They didn't follow the statute as written. As an attorney who practices in the workers' compensation realm extensively, this is a decision that I didn't feel like in good conscience let be binding on injured workers in Idaho. But this isn't what the law says. The Industrial Commission didn't look at the law and follow it. That's why we're here. There are a lot of other issues out there, but we're here because the Industrial Commission didn't follow the law. That's the bottom line.
But isn't the net effect of the Industrial Commission's decision that it impairs attorneys' abilities to recover fee? And that's really what we're here about?
No, that's not really what we're here about. We're here because the Commission didn't follow the law. That is a result of their decision. And this court has said multiple times that you want injured workers to have representation. Hogan says, when something doesn't go right in the workers' compensation system, we want competent attorneys to fix that. And that's why we're here. Because the law wasn't followed. Does that affect attorney fees? Absolutely. And is it going to affect injured workers' ability to get representation in the future if it stands? Absolutely. If an injured peace officer comes to me, if this stands, if an injured peace officer comes to me and says, hey, I understand I'm supposed to get my full rate of base salary, but my employer didn't pay it, but I got my time loss benefits for 2 years. And I'm saying, well, you got most of what you were supposed to get. You got most of it. The dispute doesn't merit the fight. In Ogun, the court says that they want attorneys to take cases where maybe the fight isn't merited, but the commission has got it wrong. And this is one of those cases, certainly. We don't know the math problem. We don't know where it comes out. I frankly don't know where it comes out on that problem. But this is definitely a case where the law wasn't applied as written. It's going to have a negative impact on peace officers and detention officers if it stands.
Speaking systemically, though, for a minute, given your expertise in this area, What about the piecemeal nature of this appeal? That is to say that the Industrial Commission's failure to address the amounts that are owed.
They frankly didn't have the information needed. This isn't a normal workers' compensation complaint. If you look at page one of the agency record, there's a specific complaint for 1100. There's a specific complaint, and that's what was filed. So you had asked about procedure and what happens with this case. This isn't even a normal workers' compensation complaint. This is a complaint filed exclusively to try to get Officer Watkins his 40-day salary. And that's it.
Was that a result, and I'm not trying to be critical, but was that a result of the failing in the pleadings not to assert that number in the initial pleading in the case? I mean, it would seem to me if that number, if there had been a number for the salary set forth and there had been a default entered, they would have based their decision on the undisputed salary number.
There is a number in the complaint. And the referee actually made a mistake in that number, but there's a number in the complaint based on his average week, Officer Watkins' average weekly wage. And that's what the referee went with.
What's that number?
Stated in the complaint or the referee?
In the complaint.
In the complaint, $13,081.60 is his gross in the 13 weeks preceding the accident. He had a...
What does that work out to as a week?
I'm not
sure. It's not $13,000 divided by 13.
Yeah. And he... The referee came up with 1,100 something.
Which is more than what was in the complaint.
Correct.
Well, but to that end, when I read the complaint and I read the form, I said to myself, why are we talking about average weekly wages? That's not part of the statute. So, I mean, I realize that the complaint is a form that the Industrial Commission has promulgated that you have to fill out. But, I mean, does that even track what the statute requires?
We don't have a definition of base rate of salary. And so I was alleging what was going to be most beneficial to my client, recognizing that if base rate of salary means what the city argues, then my client actually is giving up money for filing workers' compensation for pursuing his peace officer benefits, which are supposed to be a benefit. I don't think the legislature specifically says it, but everybody else gets 67% non-taxable. You get your 40th base salary. It's supposed to be a benefit to peace officers. And so if we say base rate of salary means what the city says, my client actually loses money by not just going with what the state insurance funds pay.
My concern is no matter what the client ends up owing money, I mean, assuming he did not just bank all of these TTD benefits and not knowing what salary the TTD benefits calculated from, he was getting that 90% tax-free, and now he's going to get salary with withholding. I mean, I worry this whole appeal doesn't end at all except with your client having a money judgment entered against him. I mean, I'm really concerned about that here.
And like I said, the statute has problems. But I don't think it's a statute we can just let stand because I don't think we can just let it go because, well, it's going to create some problems.
Well, and I completely understand that. I just question whether this was the case to pursue it because, well, I may agree with you legally. I worry at the end of the day your client's going to be stuck with a judgment that he may or may not be able to pay.
The alternative was every injured peace officer in Idaho is stuck with bad law from the Industrial Commission.
I get it. You at least would have had conflicting decisions, the point two.
But have you ever seen the Industrial Commission enter a judgment against an employee or a worker? Do they have any authority for that kind of action?
I can recall one where the Industrial Commission has actually said the injured worker owes money. I can't give you the name. But there is at least one, I think, out there.
In this post?
No, not with respect to the Peace Officer Act. But just in general. And I don't remember what the benefit was or how that worked out, but that there is at least one decision when the Industrial Commission has done it.
Thank you. Sir, thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
To each of you, as I dodge around the monitor, thank you both. The matters under consideration will render the decision. Being recessed for approximately 10 minutes.
All rise. Thank you.